Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Taylor Messer.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Agnew.
Hi, it's Grant Haggerty.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Foodish.
Yep.
Welcome back to another podcast of Not the Footy Show, our 501st show. Now, I am going to just quickly let everybody know that our special guest that we were looking to have on the 500th show was actually Vitali Klitschko, the world boxing champion. But as you can imagine, being the mayor of Kiev, he's a little bit busy with the coronavirus at the moment, so we're not probably going to get him on for a little while yet, but he has said he will come on the show at some point, so keep listening. But anyway, we've got another great show lined up for you today, and another special guest who's going to be talking about hydrofoil surfing, and that is Scott Fitzpatrick. Anyway, I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
Well, John, it's good to be back, and very different show in that we're miles apart at the moment. Trying to keep more than a 1.5-meter distance between us.
Yeah, no, it's the way of the world these days. Everybody's doing it online.
They are, and it's been interesting, hasn't it, just watching some of the stuff that's been put out online. I don't know what your thoughts are. I've been a little bit disappointed how so many of the sports have actually been just copying each other and putting the same content out.
Yeah, a lot of that's been happening. There's a lot of the same old going around, isn't there? I'm a bit over lists, I can tell you that.
Yeah, exactly. I must admit, I haven't partaken of any of these lists of my favourite players or any of that. It's a bit boring, and I don't think anyone's really interested, to be honest.
No, I did get one person asked me my favourite something or others, and I did give them five of that, but that's the last time I've indulged in any of that sort of stuff.
But I think it does show to me as well when we talk about them repeating a lot of the stuff and the various sports, their output at this time shows the lack of imagination that we have in our marketing department or communications departments across the sporting world.
Well, it's not the only area that they're lacking in, Ashley, and we'll probably talk about that a little bit later on.
Well, shall I get us started today?
I think so.
Well, for those of you who have been probably following sport would have seen that Mark Viduka gave an interview to ESPN. Now, Mark Viduka's been out of the limelight for a while, and it was amazing how the responses to that interview were. Some people were saying it was a bombshell interview. I didn't think it was. I thought it was actually a very good interview from a player that throughout his career has always been really honest. Now, one of the things he discussed in that was the disastrous 2007 Asian Cup routine and campaign rather, and you may remember, John, I was up there for that, covering that event, and I thought it was really interesting how, you know, Robbie Slater almost sort of came to the defense of Graham Arnold, who's of course his good mate, so you've got to take what he said with a little bit of a pinch of salt. But Viduka was claiming that, you know, a lot of his teammates were selfish and they tore the Socceroos apart during that campaign. He said that Graham Arnold had offered Lucas Neal the captaincy, and then when Viduka was available, didn't have the guts to tell Lucas Neal that obviously Viduka was going to keep the captaincy. And he also then sort of said that Arnold never really had control of the squad. Now, I was fortunate to have been in Germany for the 2006 World Cup as a member of the media, so saw the Australian team, witnessed Gus Hiddink, actually went to the team hotel a couple of times. And the one thing, and we've had this discussion off air, was that impressed me was Gus Hiddink laid down a whole lot of terms and conditions. For example, the players were only allowed to wear thongs in the hotel because he said it was scruffy and it was unacceptable and not the image they wanted to portray. He also was very strict at meal times in that the players had used to be sitting at, you know, tables of three or four in their little pockets. Gus Hiddink came in, he said, no, we all sit together on one table when we have a meal and nobody starts until I sit down. So again, there were these little areas of discipline. The amazing thing was when you think that the World Cup was sort of July, August of 2006, the Asian Cup was, I think, February 2007. By the time they got to Asia, all of that had gone. It was incredible that the hotel, when you went to the hotel, the players were not sitting on one table anymore. And Graham Arnold, of course, had been the assistant of Gus Hiddink. And all of the sort of, I suppose, the disciplinary things that Hiddink had put in place, within 6 months, they'd all gone. So I think what Viduka was saying was bang on the money. And what was sad was that there was nobody within the FFA and nobody as strong enough as Graham Arnold was at that point in time to make sure that, you know, those things were in place.
Yeah. I wonder if, because Hiddink was an outsider, he was able to do that. When Arnold came in, there were pre-existing relationships in place. And, you know, how much of that has an effect on the dynamics of teams?
Yeah, I think there's definitely an element of that. And if we look back as well, as Robbie Slater, to be fair, did say, the players didn't really want to be there, in that a lot of them wanted to have a break because they had been playing, you know, top-level football in Europe, because most of the players at that stage were playing in Europe. And then they'd had, obviously, the World Cup qualifying campaigns, followed by the World Cup, and then straight away they then had to come back and play in the Asian Cup. And Graham Arnold had said, you know, why didn't they have the Ollie Roos? But if we look again, it was the management at the FFA who'd been boasting, based on the World Cup performance, that they were going to win the Asian Cup. Yeah. And again, that ruffled feathers in Asia. And then, of course, you had the players not very happy. And I think, again, it proved a point that you cannot go for the cheap option when you're employing a manager of a national team.
That's true. It also opens up an interesting dynamic, I think, about the responsibilities of being selected for a national team. Now, for my mind, a national team should always be the best team you can possibly put out on the park. It's not for junior development. It's not a development team. So the idea that they would send the Ollie Roos to a major international tournament representing us as a nation, I don't like that idea. I think if it should be your number one best team every time they walk out on the park.
I totally agree with you in every aspect of that. And I think one of the things I don't like is when you have players now capped as playing an international game, when the rules of that international are not the rules of, say, a national competition or whatever. So if they're allowed to use more than the three substitutes in a game of football, yeah, or, you know, then, or they've got a bigger squad in a game of hockey, then that's not an official international in my book. That's a B-grade international, and the player should not be given the recognition that they've got an international cap playing in that game.
I agree totally. And I think players too have got to understand that it's maybe we're playing too much international sport, and now players see it as something they can pick and choose. Maybe if there was less opportunity to play at the national level, they would have jumped at that opportunity to go to an Asian Cup, regardless of how tired they were.
I think you're right, and I think what we're probably noticing now in this period is where there is no sport, you know, are we missing it? But what sport, and I'd like us to sort of look at that, or the people running sport to look at that. What sport do we want to see? Now, I did a little straw poll once on Not the Footy Show a couple of years ago and said, which would you prefer to sort of see? Would it be your international team playing or your club side playing? And it was amazing when you looked at it, geography had a lot to do with that, because India, everyone from India was saying they'd rather watch the international team. Most people in Europe said they would rather watch their club sides. So again, geographically, the cultures are very, very different.
Yeah, and it must be said, India doesn't have the club structures that exist in Europe. They just don't play sport like that.
Yeah.
But for these guys, you know, the fact that these guys who are representing their country think that they should be allowed to pick and choose which tournaments they attend, if you don't want to go, don't expect to be picked again. Simple as that. I mean, no one's place in a national team should be held for them.
No, and I mean, I think you're a very brave player if you think you can step aside, because there's always somebody who is willing to take your place in that game. And if they perform, it's going to be very, very hard to get your spot back.
Well, wasn't it Wally Grout, you know, never give a sucker an even break, as far as when it came to wicket-keeping? We've seen that, especially within the wicket-keeping ranks, specifically to cricket, where they'll play through broken fingers and all sorts of injuries because they know if they step aside, there's someone coming to take their place. More so than anywhere else.
There's a prime example in English football, John, where Steve Moran, who was playing for Southampton, was picked for England. I think Bobby Robson was the coach, and he wasn't expecting to be picked because Southampton obviously was a smaller club and they didn't get that many players picked for England in those days. And he goes, well, I've got my brother's wedding and I'm best man. And Bobby Robson goes, well, look, it's up to you, but you know, you're going to be playing. If you want to play, you can play. Anyway, went back and decided that he would be his brother's best man. And a certain player by the name of Gary Lineker took his spot. And the rest, as they say, is history. Lineker went on to a glittering England career. And Steve Moran is a player that many people won't remember.
Yeah, and that's the way it goes sometimes.
It's very sad. But I do think, you know, obviously Viduka, we had him on the show. He's always spoken straight down the line. He doesn't mess you around. And I think people forget as well when they were talking in that interview about the sort of mix up with or the relationship between him and Harry Kewell was there was a comment he made when Frank Farina was coaching. Farina, I think, and I have no proof of this, was being pressured to make Kewell the captain. And Viduka came out at that time and said, you know, look, he would make a terrible captain because he's just a quiet guy that just sits in the corner and doesn't say anything. And Viduka got slammed because, you know, Kewell was the blue-eyed boy. But his comment, if you spoke to other players of that era at that time, said it was on the money.
The thing about Mark Viduka is he doesn't seem to have an agenda. He's in Croatia, with his missus, they're running a cafe. You haven't heard boo from him about football for quite some time now. So he's obviously happy doing what he's doing. He's not angling for something. He's not saying something on behalf of someone else or any of that stuff that normally comes up when these situations arise. He's just speaking his mind.
Now, and the best part of the interview for me when they said what was his best memory looking back on his football, and he said playing in the back garden with his dad. And I think that sums up Mark Viduka.
Yeah, and it's a real pity he's not perhaps involved more in the sport because I'm sure there's a lot of young kids that could do with some guidance from a guy like Mark Viduka. And I mean that in the sense that Mark Viduka wasn't a guy known for his mesmerizing foot skills, if you know what I mean. He wasn't a guy, obviously he had some skill, but what he brought to the game was something that you don't have to be born with necessarily. You can learn a lot of what he did on a field.
He was an incredibly talented player. In my book, he was the best Australian. Way better than Tim Cahill in my estimations. Anyway.
He was the best player, I think, because he was a pure football player in a team sense, not in an individual sense. There's plenty of guys around in lots of sports that is individual players, mesmerizing with their skills and can do all the tricks and all of that sort of stuff. But it's the guys that hunker down and do the real strong team things when it's called for that stick out for me. And he's one of them.
Well, prime example, I mean, everyone criticizes his record for Australia that he didn't get as many goals, but he was played in a very different role when he played for Australia to the one he played in at Leeds. And I'll never forget the day watching at the Confederations Cup in Germany in 2005 and Australia lost to Argentina. Argentina put two players on Viduka in that game, and he still managed to win a penalty and set up a goal for John Aloisi. And that, to me, when you had a team like Argentina putting two players on it, they told you how good Viduka was.
Oh, yeah, and the respect that other sides had for him.
Yeah, exactly.
Hi, I'm Mark Viduka, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Okay, well, it's time for our guest on the show this time. And as we mentioned, we thought we'd go with something that was a little bit related to social distancing. And that is the sport of hydrofoil surfing, where the surfboard is above the water. Now, this is a craze that's really beginning to take off around the world. And one of the men that's really been hooked by it is Scott Fitzpatrick, who joins us now. Scott Fitzpatrick, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Hi, Ash. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's good to finally pin you down, because when we met up, you were telling me all about this hydrofoil surfing, and having looked at a bit of it, it looks like it's a craze that's beginning to catch on, but I believe it's actually been around for a while.
Yeah, Ash, it's certainly taken my interest. I've thrown out all my other surfboards and paddleboards, and I'm 2 years into riding the foil board. But I think it started about 15 years ago. A guy in Hawaii had an attempt at it, Laird Hamilton, where he used snowboard boots and strapped himself in on the board. So it's been around for a little while, but it's only the last 3 or 4 years that it's taken off, and you're starting to see more of these things around.
What was it that appealed to you to throw out all your other boards?
Well, if you ever see some footage of it, the speed that these things go is quite incredible. And then secondly, you don't need much of a wave. You just need a ramp to get this thing going, and then you're off. So what ends up happening is you end up surfing away from all the crowd. So I love the, I love the social distancing aspect of it, which is pretty relevant at the moment. So you get to spend a lot of time surfing by yourself.
Now, I mean, to learn to surf is not the easiest thing in the first place, but is it really difficult to get adapted to this? Because I must admit, reading some of the people that had attempted it said it took quite a few attempts before you get it right.
Yeah, the learning curve's pretty steep. If you're a surfer or a stand-up paddler, you've got to relearn everything. In surfing, a lot of everything is around having your weight on your back foot. Once you get up on the wing on this foil, you've got to have all your weight forward. So the first 6 months, there's a lot of pain, and the foil is quite sharp. So if you fall and the foil hits you, it's going to do some damage. My wife calls it my girlfriend, and every now and then she bites me.
I mean, you mentioned that, and that's been one of the criticisms of it, hasn't it? That it is more dangerous than surfing. I mean, there was a horrible accident I saw when I was reading up for this interview to one of the Japanese surfers. The board caught him in the face, and he had a lot of stitches.
You're going 30, 40 kilometres an hour at speed with this weapon underneath your board, so you've got to really be... You've got to spend the time to understand how it's going to react, and you just cannot surf these things in crowds. If there's any criticism, it's not the board's fault, it's the rider, that you've got to stay away from crowds on these things. They're just going too fast, and if something, something untoward happens, you're going to hit somebody at speed, and it is physically like a weapon sitting underneath your surfboard. It's like a big machete coming at you.
And are you connected to it like a normal surfboard? Is there the ankle strap so that your board, if you do fall off, you don't lose it?
Yeah, you've got a leg rope, and there's one. Normally, I've got one foot strap, but you've got a leg rope that everyone will wear, so it doesn't go flying too far. But every now and then, leg ropes snap as well, so you've got to have a good leg rope. Some people do use two foot straps. I'm a little bit wary of that, because I just think you're going to do your knees and ankles with that, but maybe that's for the young kids.
Now, we mentioned there, obviously, the danger, and you're saying it is a weapon. I mean, there's been some talk that surfers like yourself using these hydrofoils should have to have a license. What's your view on that?
No, I don't think so. I laughed at some of the... some of the most dangerous places I surf are where all the beginners are riding males, the big 10-foot-long males. I think they're more dangerous in a crowded surf than what I am. But I think it's just respect for the surf craft that it's so much fun. However, you just need to ride it away from other people. And the attraction of the sport is that you don't need to ride the best wave. If anything, we're like a really fat wave. And the wave doesn't even have to break. It just needs a ramp to get us going. So what the sport's done is open up the whole ocean. And if I just explain that, you can either ride it in the surf, or when it's windy enough, you can take it out into the open ocean and just catch some of the ocean swells. And they call that downwinding. And so it's opened up the whole world, the whole ocean, to everybody.
I mean, that's the amazing thing, because some of the clips I've seen, it doesn't look like the surf is that high, yet these guys are getting a really good run. And then, you know, the interesting thing is you don't have to paddle back out. You pump your way back out.
Yeah, in the surf, the good guys can catch a wave, pump back out, catch another one. It's pretty hard on the legs. And there's a whole level of skill to do that. So normally you'd be a couple of years in before you could do that. I was out this morning with some guys who could catch three or four waves in a row. And once again, they don't have to catch the breaking wave. They just need to be able to get back on the swell. So that's pretty cool. And then the open ocean one's the real interesting one, where they can go kilometres on these things. They're out in the deep ocean. They just need a little bit of wind behind them, a little bit of chop, and the good guys can go for a few kilometres.
I mean, so it sounds to me as well, you need to be very fit to do this.
I think having a surfing background will help, but also a lot of it is core strength. You need to have a strong core, or develop a strong core for the balance element of it.
Right. And I mean, you mentioned the legs there. I mean, it must be a bit weird adapting the strength to your front leg rather than your back leg. And then, as you said there, the pumping is really hard work on the legs, something that maybe surfers don't have to do as much.
That's right. Surfers won't have that feeling. But, you know, once it's like doing 20 or 30 jump squats when you're pumping it back out. So maybe the young kids can do 30 or 40 jump squats. At about 17 to 20, the lactic acid building up, and I need to have a little rest.
Now, I mean, you mentioned there about sort of staying away from the sort of normal surfers, and there's no need to be in amongst the waves with them. What is the reaction from a lot of the surfing community to these hydrofoils?
I think it's a mixed reaction. Most of the, just trying to think how I'll determine this. I think most people are pretty happy if we stay away. They're pretty intrigued by it. I think the only pressure on the sport is when people are surfing them in areas that it's far too busy, which is happening at the moment. There's a couple of places on the Gold Coast where the foilboard community are in too close with all the surfers. Where I am down at Cabarita, there's plenty of space. All the young kids are pretty intrigued by it. Probably the barrier to the sport at the moment is the cost. So the foil's about $2,000 and the board's about $1,800. So it's about, you know, a good $3,500 to $4,000 exercise to get yourself set up. So that sort of prohibits a lot of people from taking up sport. I'm sure the young kids are thinking for $4,000 they can buy themselves 5 or 6 shortboards.
Yeah, and then there's, of course, the time it's going to take for you to get proficient on the board as well.
Yeah, so a lot of the older crew go, you know what, it's just going to take too long to... It's going to cost me too much, and it's going to take too long to learn how to do this. But you're starting to see a lot of people get towed behind them on jet skis, get towed behind them in the river on boats, so that's a good place to learn how to do this. So a lot of people are having their first attempt at it. You know, getting towed behind skis or boats in the river to get used to the sensation of being, you know, up in the air. A typical foil's about, you know, three foot in the air.
So it's quite high off the water then.
Yeah, they have different length masts. So yeah, it can be, you know, 3 foot. I've seen a few of the kite surf ones are probably 4 foot out of the water. So they're using them for kite surfing now as well. And also windsurfers have got them on, starting to use them as well.
So how do you get when, you know, if you imagine the board's in the water, what is it that propels it to suddenly get up to that 3 foot and you can just off you go?
Yeah, so I need a little bit of momentum and a little bit of a swell with some steepness on it just to give yourself some momentum. And then the foil will engage. It's a funny feeling. You can feel the foil lifting underneath you. It feels like an aeroplane taking off. And you would know from your physics background, Ash, that it's called the Bernoulli effect, if you'd like to explain that.
Well, I don't know if I can explain it, but it's all to do with the air pressure and the air pushing across it. And it was actually the one thing I did understand in physics. And as I said to you off air, I failed my physics by 1% twice. It's the only thing I do remember.
Yeah, so it just creates pressure upward and forward with the water flow over the shape of the foil. And so once you've got it up and riding, you can go quite long distances with it, which is the surreal part of the sport. You quite often come off the end of a wave and you go, my God, mathematically, how did that just do that?
So, I mean, at the moment, are there any competitions around the world on the hydrofoils?
Not at the moment. Well, in a way, they're starting to do some inter-island competitions, long-distance ones, and that's the downwinders. And I have seen in the States they're just, you know, starting to do a few sprint competitions on them, but that's about it at the moment. I'm sure as the sport develops, there will be a lot more people, you know, a lot more people interested in competing in one way, shape, form or another on them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking, obviously, you've got the extreme games, and then with surfing coming into the Olympic Games, if, of course, they actually happen, you know, there's a chance that the foils could come in after that, seeing as the IOC seem to want everything that's quicker and faster.
Well, they are. It's, you know, with the Olympics, with snowboarding coming in, it's sort of one of those, you know, extreme sports. But you're starting to see these foils under, you would have seen them under super yachts now, under skiffs, under normal boats. So the technology is starting to be applied, you know, in lots of different marine craft at the moment.
I mean, you've been surfing all your life. You've obviously really enjoy this because you've got rid of all your other boards, but is it, in your opinion, a far greater experience, or is it the fact that you can do it on any kind of water pretty much?
I think there's two or three things. One is you can have as much fun on a 6-inch wave as a 6-foot wave on the foil. It really is that sensation of low-level flying. Obviously, as the waves get bigger, you get a lot more speed and there, you know, it becomes a lot more consequence to it. But what I love about it is so many days that I would never ride a surfboard that can be so much fun on the foil board.
Right.
So it gets you out in the water a whole lot more. It's just that learning curve, that first 6 months, that you need to get through.
And are the guys that are really proficient, as you mentioned there, are they doing the bigger waves, or is it really just too dangerous because of the pace at which you're coming off that wave?
No, there's some guys out there now are starting to surf the 10, 15, 20-foot waves, but they're getting towed into those waves. So
right.
They've got a jet ski towing them in to get the speed up to catch these things.
That's a bit crazy to me, it sounds anyway.
Yeah, I think you need a certain level of craziness to even attempt that. There's a fairly big consequence if you get those ones wrong. And you've got to have the right gear. You've got to be really confident about your gear as well.
I mean, as I mentioned, there was that Japanese surfer who got a bad head injury. Is there a need for people to wear helmets, or is it a case of literally not going out until you've become, you know, proficient at a good level to be able to actually go out and master the board?
I got a helmet myself for the first time, just for the larger waves, and it wasn't so much worried about the foil. It's more about the speed if you fall off when you hit the water. It's like hitting your head on concrete.
No, I can imagine that.
Yeah, it wasn't so much about the foil. It was about, you know, the smack as you hit the water. So there's starting to see a few guys now that will wear helmets out there, but it's certainly not mainstream helmets at the moment.
And, I mean, were you one of the first in your area to be out there on the foil?
Yeah, there's just a few of us. I watched it for about 2 months or 3 months, and there's a fantastic Hawaiian kid called Kai Lenny, who, you know, if you follow him on Instagram or watch what he does, you know, I went, okay, now I get what the whole buzz is about this thing. And so, yeah, I went and bought a board, and I went and tried to teach myself basically off watching YouTube videos.
Oh, there's plenty of people have done that lately in various sports, and more of us doing it at the moment in this period of isolation.
That's right, so it may be a good time to learn to mind surf it.
Absolutely. Well, Scott, it's been great catching up with you, and enjoy your isolation surfing on your foil.
Thanks, Ash. Great chat.
This is Gary Lineker, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, that was Scott Fitzpatrick talking about foiling in the world of surfing. And it certainly is, John, and a sport that you've got to have a bit of money to do it. But interesting that they were saying that it takes a long time to master the board and the different skills because your weight distribution has to be different. But it's also a very dangerous sport in that if you come off it, you can get caught by the board or also hitting the water, as Scott said there. When you're traveling at about sort of 30 Ks, it's like hitting a brick wall.
Yeah, it's funny how much danger plays a part in our enjoyment of something, isn't it?
Well, some people, I must admit, not so much with me, but we mentioned in there as well the Bernoulli effect and how that works. And it's just if to give people a bit of an example as to how the hydrofoil works, it's sort of the shape of, for example, of the wing on an aircraft. Helps the air to travel for a longer period over the top of the wing, and that helps it to travel faster, and it reduces the air pressure, and it also increases lift. So that's what the Bernoulli effect is. As I mentioned there, it was one of the few things I learned in physics when I was at school. I didn't learn much more, I have to say.
I was going to ask, where did this knowledge come from, Ashley?
It's funny. It was just something that really intrigued me. And I mean, I'll give you an example that we had. So if you have two trains moving in opposite directions, and if you threw a pebble out the window of one, the sort of pressure from both of them will suspend the pebble in the air until they've passed, and then it will drop straight down. And that is, again, an example of the Bernoulli effect.
Oh, very good. Very good. I'll have to sign you up with the West Australian Education Department, mate.
Certainly not when it comes to science. Please don't.
It had nothing to do with figuring out how you could swing your bat faster, did it?
No, I don't think so. Although maybe that was why it had that sort of groove on the back for the aerodynamics from the cross bat shots.
Now, let's move on, Ashley, because there's something I want to ask you in relation to sport and what's happening at the moment with coronavirus, et cetera, et cetera. And people are starting to look ahead towards when all this is over and we can go back to normal. But we've heard a lot of sports coming out and claiming how much harm the coronavirus is doing to their organisations. I want to know where all the money went. Where did all the money go? All of these organisations that for a long time have been sitting back just raking it in from broadcast deals and players on multi-million dollar contracts, where's all the money gone now?
Yeah, look, John, I think that's going to be one of the big inquests after all of this, in my opinion. And I think we're going to see the administrative structures of sport change dramatically. I also think you're going to see less government handouts because the amount the government is giving to the people to try and help them through this period, there is not going to be the money for sport. And we've been saying that that pot was shrinking as it is. If you look at the IOC and the Olympic sports, the IOC, again, are going to be in a huge amount of trouble financially because Japan, the Olympics, are not going to make the money that they were going to make. Let's face that as a fact. They're already having to now pay for venues that they'd already thought they had booked, but because they're booked, they're looking to have to pay compensation now to some of the people who bought houses in the village that they were going to live in because they don't want them now to move in for another year. There's a whole lot of ramifications that people haven't thought about. The IOC, again, are trying to negotiate their way, I believe, through the deal with NBC and also their sponsors as to how those deals are going to work and whether they're actually going to continue next year. So I don't think you're going to see the sports that are normally given. And I think it was $540 million split between all of the sports after the Rio Olympics. I don't think that pot's going to be as full this time around as it was last time. But so we've got to change the way sport is administered. We've got to stop having these board members flying all around the world every month or every 2 months for board meetings. That has just got to stop, and they're going to have to do it remotely because it's just a waste of money, and especially when they go in business class. And again, some of the senior executives, do they really have to be at every international match? I don't think they do.
No, I don't think they do either. And I think that, you know, this is showing up a lot of this situation now is proving that you don't need to be in the same room to have these meetings. These meetings are going on at the moment. If these sporting organisations aren't doing these meetings by remote at the moment, then how are they running their sports, and how are they trying to work out how they're going to fix the problems that they now face? So obviously you can do it. You got no reason not to do it like this in the future.
No, well, if you remember, we got sort of told off because we'd said that one of the subcommittees at the FIH was going, and then the person involved actually rang me up and said, look, this is the way it works. The National Association set aside some money for us to attend those meetings, and we feel we achieve more when we fly to Switzerland. Well, I'm sorry, I think there are times when that would be the case, but you can't be having subcommittees flying around the world, or even flying around Australia for that point, trying to sort these things out. That, I mean, you know, every time, you know, you're looking at probably $2,000 if someone's going to fly to Perth for a meeting that's going to go for 2 days with the accommodation, the airfares, the meals, their allowances. There's $2,000, bang, you know, it's a lot of money, and that money could save on, say, two kids or four children's registration as a junior.
What I found more immediate as far as ramifications in here in Australia, and perhaps the situation exists overseas as well, is we had Channel 9 come out last week and launch an extraordinary attack on the ARU. Now, Channel 9 is the broadcaster, along with Foxtel, of the rugby league. And they basically came out and said, you blokes have been mismanaging this sport for years. Get your act together because we're sick of it.
Just quickly there, you said the ARU, I think.
Oh, ARL. Yeah, sorry, the ARL. Yeah, Australian Rugby League. I mean, the ARU, that's another basket case. But the ARL, in particular Australian Rugby League, they're now offside with their broadcaster. And why? Because they've squandered all the money that they've been given over the years, and now they've got nothing. So where did that money go? What has it been squandered on? It can't just be players' salaries.
No, I think, John, it's the administration. And if you look at some of the sports administrations and the amount of staff that they have now compared to what they used to have. Now, if you looked at the end of last year, the FFA, Football Federation of Australia, had more employees than FIFA. And FIFA runs the world game, runs it across the world. And you go, hang on, how is that possible? And why is that the requirement? So that one, again, scares me. Then when you look at the salaries that the top people are on, and if you look at some of the sporting organizations, the structure is wrong. Now, I had worked my probationary period at Football West, and I left. Now, there are more staff there now than when I was there. Probably, I wouldn't say double, but at least one and a half, you know, half as many staff employed. And yet the structure has not been changed. Now, a board member, when I resigned, I said, it's just an organization that can't be run the way it is because the structure's wrong. It's not going to work, and you're never going to make it work unless you change the structure. But the structure is still exactly the same 10 years down the track, and it's top heavy in management.
All right. And look, you hear stories, and we can't say too much, but you do hear stories about people who are bought into these sorts of organisations to do specific jobs, be it generally it's along the lines of, you know, due diligence and those sorts of areas and compliance, et cetera, et cetera. And these people leave after a very, very short time because they're not able to do their job within the structure that exists at the time. And that happens across a lot of sports, as you well know.
Yeah, and it's sad. I mean, the FFA is another example. Rob Sherman was brought in as technical director, and he's resigned just over a year later because he wasn't allowed to make the changes that he was brought in to make because people didn't want to make those hard decisions or go down that path. And it's like, well, then why did you appoint him? And that's the thing that frustrates me. But I think the scary thing, John, as you say, is there's funding money that the government has given, and some of the blame must fall at the government. Now, I had a meeting with one of the sports, well, not that long ago, and they didn't receive $1 million a year in funding. So they were saying that if you don't receive $1 million, you do not have to account for how you spend that money. If you receive over $1 million in government funding, you must account for where that money is spent. But what I think is happening is the government is not monitoring where a lot of that money is being spent. And instead of it going into development or youth programs, it is going on administration. And that is where the government needs a slap on the wrist, and they need to start setting up somebody to make sure that the money they're putting into the sport, if there is going to be any in the future, I don't think there will be, but goes to the people it's intended to go to.
And sports funding is a hugely politicized event. I mean, we've seen here just recently in Australia that how politicized sports funding can become, and it's not necessarily done on merit. I mean, when you're giving people swimming pools they didn't ask for and don't want, you've got to question what exactly is going on in the sphere of governments that allows them to just throw this money away like that.
Well, I think the scary thing as well was with the political promises that were made in the past election, was some of those promises were made to private entities.
Yeah.
And you go, hang on a sec, that's where's the community benefit in that?
Oh, yeah, and we've got organisations who do have, you know, multi-hundred-million-dollar broadcasting deals sticking their hands out for government funding because they happen to run some little tiny community program somewhere. Well, you can pay for that yourselves, boys. You don't need the taxpayer paying for that.
No, exactly. I think it's going to be a very, very different landscape. And hopefully people do actually ask questions as to where the money's gone. But what it needs, John, is not just you and I. It needs the stakeholders, the clubs and the club presidents, who then go to the state body to say to the state body, hey, hang on a sec, you need to ask this question of our national federation. What has happened to the money? Where is it? Why were we in this position? And they need to put it in writing so that there is a trail and you can get the actual responses.
Yeah, that's not likely to happen, though. I mean, these people are very good at slipping around questions that need to be asked, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, you know me, John. I've always been a dreamer, and I always hope that we are actually going to see this world where people are open and honest and there is integrity in sport.
Oh, you've still got that big picture of John Lennon on your bedroom wall, haven't you? Imagining?
No, not him, but I think it's Walter Mitty, probably.
Yeah, something like that. Do you want to do an outro there, mate?
All right. Well, John, that probably wraps it up for another podcast. I'm sorry I'm not sitting across you in our normal sort of spot, but it's been good catching up, and I hope you'll stay safe. And everyone around the world, please take care of yourselves, because we want you to keep listening, and we want sport back on the agenda as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I had a little bit of a chat with my co-host on the reverse stick the other day, and he was saying how much he's missing sport because he's starting to stack on a little bit of extra kilos. And I'm sure there's a few people around like him that, you know, probably need a little bit of a run occasionally, Ashley. I'm actually the opposite way. I find that if I don't have activity, I lose weight because I lose my appetite. I need the activity to keep my appetite up.
Yeah, well, I need to lose a few pounds, I'll admit that. I have lost a couple, which is good, but could do with probably a couple more.
Oh, good to speak to you, Ash.
Take care.
See ya. We'll be back next week.